Bienvenidos a Ley Foro Cripto Derecho, un programa donde discutimos las intersecciones entre el derecho y la tecnología blockchain. Este podcast ha sido traído gracias a la Comisión de Tecnología del Colegio de Abogados y Abogadas de Puerto Rico. Las opiniones vertidas en este episodio son exclusivamente de los partícipes, no representan necesariamente las opiniones del Colegio de Abogados y Abogadas de Puerto Rico ni constituyen asesoría legal. Para comentarios, sugerencias o auspicios, puede contactarnos escribiendo a podcast@capr.org o visitando tecnocaapr.org. Saludos y gracias por sintonizar nuevamente a este programa. En el episodio de hoy vamos a estar hablando de lo que son los Central Bank Digital Currencies. Mi nombre es Andrew Mercado Vázquez, soy el presidente de la subcomisión sobre blockchain de lo que sería el Colegio de Abogados y Abogadas de Puerto Rico. Y la invitada de hoy es la licenciada Anessa Santos. El episodio va a ser en inglés, pero para aquellas personas que nos escuchan que prefieren contenido en español, posteriormente vamos a estar publicando un episodio donde nosotros repasamos básicamente lo que sería el contenido del episodio de hoy. Así que sintonicen para las próximas publicaciones del podcast del Colegio de Abogados y Abogadas de Puerto Rico. Y ahora vamos a estar transicionando a lo que sería pues una conversación en inglés con la licenciada Anessa Santos. Anessa, thank you so much for joining us today. We're privileged and so happy and honored to have you on the podcast. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm really thrilled to be here. I'm excited. Puerto Rico is a beautiful nation in the Caribbean, and I miss it. It's been a few years since I've been back and enjoyed the song of the Cokies.
it's been too long then. We look forward to having you over, and the Puerto Rico bar has its doors wide open for you. So whenever you want to visit, you come by.
All right. I'm looking forward to it.
So as you know, today's conversation is going to be centered around what's probably an issue that might be under the radar, as far as I can tell, especially now that, you know, as far as crypto goes, as far as blockchain goes, there's been a bit of a winter going on. So with that, CBDCs have kind of just flown a little bit under the radar, even though they're hugely active, as you're going to certainly talk to us about. But before we get into that, maybe you can tell us a little bit about how you came to you know, consider CBDCs as being something important and something that you consider relevant for the discussion.
Yeah, absolutely. So I've been practicing law in the state of Florida for 20 years, and I started as a public defender in Fort Myers, the city of Fort Myers, just a little bit north of Naples. Mm-hmm. And while I was in that position, I represented a gentleman from Guatemala who was working in the tomato fields of Immokalee. Mm-hmm. And when he was on his way to Western Union, he was pulled over by a police officer, and he and his friend were removed from the truck, searched for no good reason under pretext. And in the search, they found the money that he had saved picking tomatoes.
Okay.
And said, "This, you're a Guatemalan migrant worker. This is too much cash. Obviously, it's for drugs." And they took it under the rules of criminal forfeiture and then arrested him, charged him with resisting arrest without violence. When I read the police report, I said that he had no lawful reason to even pull over the truck. He had no lawful reason to arrest my client. He just wanted to shake him down for the cash. Mm-hmm. I got the criminal charges thrown out, but I wasn't able to pursue the return of the money that was stolen by the police officer because I was a public defender, which meant I was limited to defending criminal charges. And to get the money back, I would have had to have brought a civil suit.
Okay.
And so that bothered me. And then, you know, you fast forward 15 years, when I learned about blockchain and cryptocurrencies, what they are, how they work, I got really excited because I saw this as being the solution to my Guatemalan migrant worker's problem. You see, he couldn't open a bank account to put the cash in that he earned from picking tomatoes because the bank would not accept his Guatemalan passport.
Right.
And so I thought I would just put a Bitcoin ETM out there on the tomato fields in Immokalee, and that all the workers could just put their cash into the Bitcoin ETM. They could convert it into Bitcoin or maybe a stable coin, right? Like Tether or USDC, convert it into that, right? And then send it digitally to their families back home. But then I found out that I couldn't do that because the regulations in the United States are so burdensome. It requires the Bitcoin ATM companies to use the same know your customer anti-money laundering identification procedures as a bank. And so I was right back where I started, and I said, well, surely I can figure this out. And in the process over the last 7 years of chasing this problem around, I have learned about a new form of cryptocurrency called a central bank digital currency. And what I don't like about this is it makes this current problem worse. Mm-hmm. And it makes it worse because it's more centralized than the banking and financial system that we currently have. It's going to be controlled by fewer people who will have complete and total access to the bank accounts, the identity, the information, and control over the transactions of every single one of us, so that if they don't like what we tweeted, or they think that we are driving our car around too much, or we've taken too many trips on an airplane in the last year, they can just completely shut down our accounts, so that the financial exclusion that was experienced by my Guatemalan client is about to be shared among us all.
So the issue that you've pointed out really is an issue as far as beyond just black letter law. Then it's more an issue of policy. It's more an issue of what do we do with our financial ability within that context. Is that right?
Right. So it's both. It's how do we want to transact with one another and within our societies? And what are the rules and the procedures that we want to recognize or to put in place? And, you know, what's really frustrating about this for me is to see the banks, the financial institutions, the regulators, these big organizations that are global, like the World Economic Forum, the Financial Action Task Force, the International Organization of Securities Commissioners, and on International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, what do they always say? They say, we're doing this for your own protection. We're tracking and tracing your identity and your every transaction so that we can protect you against corrupt organizations, terrorists, money laundering, human trafficking, kidnapping, right? Drug cartels. This is the story that they feed us. But what I have uncovered in the last 7 years of my law practice is that they have been lying to us. Not only have all of their expanded rules and regulations made it that much harder for us to transact, have made it that much more challenging to send remittances and cross-border transactions, but it's made it easier for them to control us. And also, they are the ones that are still continually engaging in the very same criminal activity that they say they are protecting us from. They are the criminals. And so, that's what really freaked me out.
Okay. Now, let's take a step back and let's talk about more or less what the idea is behind a central bank digital currency in the first place. I've heard some people try to argue that it's a method for achieving a little bit more financial inclusion. What's your take on that? Are there concerns about how to ensure that CBDCs don't exacerbate existing inequalities? I mean, I think that's more or less what you're addressing, but there is anything specific about that that concerns you?
Yeah, here's what they're saying. Mm-hmm. They're saying that they're developing this great new system that everybody's going to be able to participate in and that it's going to solve the problem of financial exclusion. Mm-hmm. And they say it's going to solve this problem because they intend to issue to every person on the planet a government-issued ID together with a bank account. Now, they've rolled this out in beta testing in both, I don't want to speak out of turn, India and in Nigeria. And there are mm-hmm. a lot of problems that went wrong with this, right? And so what happens is this becomes the only banking system that any person on the planet will be permitted to participate in. So that if you want to trade a cow for cucumbers, you will need to utilize this singular medium of exchange to mm-hmm. assist you unless somebody agrees to trade you a cow for cucumbers, right? This will be your only medium of exchange. So it effectively captures everyone on the planet into a singular system that is surveilled completely and also controlled completely. Mm-hmm. It's surveilled and controlled. And so think about it from the perspective of what we just saw happen during the pandemic with the trucker protest in Canada.
In Canada, right.
Mm-hmm.
That's
they
right.
They shut down their bank accounts because Justin Trudeau had the authority to command Canadian banks to identify the truckers that were protesting by facial recognition and mm-hmm. also by neighbors and things that would, you know, tell on them to the government. They shut down the bank accounts so they couldn't transact. So Americans got together and started sending them Bitcoin so that they could utilize the Bitcoin and purchase whatever it was that they needed from vendors that would accept Bitcoin. And Justin Trudeau freaked out and said, shut down the Bitcoin network. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, everybody in the Bitcoin network laughed at him because he obviously doesn't know how it works. But this is exactly the problem, is that when you have a single point of control over a financial system, what are you going to do when they turn you off, when they shut you down? You will not be able to drive your children to school. You will not be able to leave the island of Puerto Rico because, God forbid, you have too many carbon emissions. You won't be allowed to buy a plane ticket. How are you going to get enough food and supplies onto the island of Puerto Rico? Because presumably you're going to need a boat or a plane to bring them in, but they don't want any of those carbon emissions, right? So everything is going to have to be powered by some sort of renewable energy generating ship. This is a problem. Puerto Rico is essentially going to be entirely isolated and or controlled.
So when we talk about CBDCs, we are talking about a closed private blockchain, are we not?
No, you're talking about, right, if I want to get highly technical, if mm-hmm. I really want to get highly technical, we are talking about a publicly accessible, permissioned blockchain.
Okay, so it's permissioned.
Right, it's permissioned by the Federal Reserve.
Okay, so the central bank, okay.
Right. The Federal Reserve mm-hmm. banking system here is our central bank system in the United States, mm-hmm. comprised of, I think it's 12 member banks, right? Four of the presidents, mm-hmm. four of those presidents take a rotating turn onto the Federal Open Market Committee and is joined by the Board of Governors and U.S. Secretary of the Treasury. And it's those 13 individuals, there's 13 seats on the FOMC. Right mm-hmm. now it's at 12. There's an open seat on the Board of Governors. Those 13 maximum positions control the global reserve currency monetary policy for 8 billion people on the planet. It's the most outrageous, ridiculous thing I've ever heard in human history, that 13 people should have that power. Mm-hmm. They should not. They should not have that kind of power. 13 people get to say how 8 billion live their lives. This is insanity.
Okay. So, but that means then that if it's a permissioned public blockchain, What do you say to those people that say, well, okay, well, it's permission, but maybe that's enough transparency or more transparency that we have currently? Maybe we can monitor this a little bit more. What do you say to those
people? Permission has nothing to do with transparency. Mm-hmm. Those are completely I almost was going to say something in Cuban Spanish when they see it, but
so it's there's a main difference.
That would be
there.
A bad word. I can't say that. Que tiene de ver.
So, but it is different then. Okay.
Yeah. So there's no transparency here. Mm-hmm. I don't know why people would think that there. What does transparency have to do with it? So Bitcoin is a transparent because of the way that it was designed, but transparency is not an inherent quality for any blockchain. Take, for example, IBM Hyperledger Fabric.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's a private permissioned blockchain that doesn't have any transparency to the public, and it's only open and available to consortium participants.
So is there an iteration of a CBDC that you would be able to say, okay, that might work, it could accomplish certain objectives, and it wouldn't put in jeopardy our ability to transact as individuals? Is there a iteration of a CBDC that you could agree with?
No, because of the letter C, central.
Okay. Which is kind of contrary to the whole idea of a blockchain to begin with. Would we agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. So when we're talking about policy around CBDCs, what do you think is driving policy, for example, in the U.S., where we have the Fed actually being a part of this overall arcing plan of having a digital currency and just phasing out eventually any other form of transaction? What do you think is the policy idea behind that? Is there something deep there that we're not taking into account?
Well, it's really great that we don't have to guess at this because they've said so out loud in black and white and frequently over the past few years. And that is they share the same goals as the World Economic Forum.
Which are?
That you will own nothing and you will be happy.
Right. So you as an attorney, what are you seeing in your practice? Or what exactly do you think is happening on the ground? Because we know that it's not exactly a topic that's, you know, discussed in depth. We see it on headlines. We see it being talked about maybe in general. But you're on the ground. You're seeing how these technologies are affecting individuals. How do you see this changing over time?
Well, you know, that's really interesting because I think I live in an alternate universe because I have these conversations with people at least 3 times a week about what's happening with the development of the FedNow system. And, you know, when was the last time you checked CBDC tracker? And did you see that such and such nation came online and rolled it out in a beta? And where are we, you know, here in the U.S. with our CBDC? And so what I see happening is Operation Choke Point 2.0, which is a formal written policy by the Biden administration to attack and tear down all decentralized finance and cryptocurrency related projects, right? Anything that's not traditional finance. And we see that what's happening, my clients are getting letters from their banks.
And, really?
Yeah, like actual letters in the mail from the banks notifying them that unfortunately, due to recent adjustments made by the Federal Reserve, that they will no longer be able to continue to provide financial services to my clients. I mean, it's right there in the letter. This is a major problem. They're choking off the industry. And the reason why is because it presents a challenge, a legitimate challenge to the global hegemony of the dollar. This is why we're doing this. And this is no more exemplified than Custodia Bank's application for a Federal Reserve Bank charter. And that would be Caitlin Long with Custodia Bank, right? Mm-hmm. And in response, you know, they gave her, I think it was like a 70 or 80 page written response, which is twice as long than they had, twice as long as any rejection letter that they had ever written. And the reasons for it were was total ludicrous. It was just insanity. It didn't make any sense whatsoever. It wasn't at all logical or reasonable. It's flat out discrimination, choking off an entire industry from banking and financial services because they can, because they have unchecked power as a quasi private agency, the Federal Reserve. It's not federal. It doesn't answer to the people.
Right. Right. You mentioned the World Economic Forum. You sent over, right, you know, in preparation of today's podcast, you sent over a document from the World Economic Forum, and anyone listening can just look this up on Google. It's the Central Bank Digital Currency Policy Maker Toolkit.
Oh, yeah.
I read this, and it was interesting. And let's just go ahead and just cherry pick a couple of things that I think are interesting to go over. On page 6, there is this brief summary of cost-benefit analysis associated, or you know, to the facilitation of what the toolkit is really talking about, and key opportunities under wholesale CBDCs. It says, and I quote, could improve efficiency and speed and costs for cross-border interbank payments, potential to bypass correspondent banking systems, and challenges related to legacy infrastructures, intermediary operating hours or cutoff times, and other interbank processes. And this is from the wholesale CBDC point of view. Do you think that, regardless of what you're saying, let's just take into account the potential pitfalls and the potential threats that you're pointing out, even if that all turns out to be, you know, considered true by everybody, do you think that the fact that it's so convenient would be enough for it to be adopted by, just for lack of a better term, the masses?
Well, the masses aren't going to have a choice.
Mm-hmm.
It's you either participate in this system or, you know, start trading in salt.
Yeah, right.
Nobody's going to have a choice. But I think what's really interesting, and I had to, like, you know, pull the document up real quick, and I'm right there with you now on page 6 on the wholesale CBDC key opportunities. And I think what's really interesting about this is that it completely ignores the fact that the only reason why cross-border transfers are challenging today is because of regulatory controls. It has nothing to do with technology capabilities. Mm-hmm. It has everything to do with regulatory controls.
Okay, so to you, in your what you're just saying, basically, if I'm allowed to simply paraphrase it, is that they're looking for a solution to a problem that doesn't exist naturally. It exists as a result of, you know, excessive regulation.
That's a beautiful paraphrase. Very nicely done. You said it better than I did.
Well, I mean, the purpose of the subcommittee, which is the subcommittee I chair, that I have the honor of chairing, which is the subcommittee on blockchain, and the wider, you know, objective of the Puerto Rico Bar, which is the Colegio Abogado y Abogada de Puerto Rico, is to bring forward different points of view about discussions that are very important on the long term. So what you're saying basically is that here's a solution being offered for a problem that could be fundamentally eliminated if we looked at this from a different point of view. So maybe what you would suggest is maybe different ways of managing all these political and these regulatory barriers across borders or across different countries or different governments. Would that be a fair assessment?
Yeah. So there are, you know, I work in the payment space now, mm-hmm. right, for 7 years, almost exclusively. And that was
right.
Totally by accident, but I'm so thankful I'm there because if anything, I definitely have a lot of passion for this fight, and it's what gets me out of bed every mm-hmm. day. Right, is I see the CBDC just barreling down at us like an 18-wheeler truck. Like, I'm just racing as fast as I can for counter solutions as mm-hmm. like complementary currencies. And I work with a lot of companies in the payment space. The technology to do cross-border payments has been available for decades outside of the SWIFT banking system. The SWIFT banking system, of course, is your legacy infrastructure. Yeah. The challenge is that the U.S. government has so much firepower and so much control and influence over other nations of the world that they have put together this coalition of generally Western banks, meaning Europe and the United States. And they've said, if you don't play by our rules, right? They pointed Panama, they pointed other countries like the Cook Islands and the BVI and the Cayman Islands and the Bahamas and what have you. And they point and they say, you play by our rules or we're going to put you on what's called the gray list, or you're going to go all the way on the black list. Mm-hmm. And what that means is they will refuse intra-country transactions with other banks. So like, for example, I work with folks in the nation of Suriname in South America, which is a former colony of the Dutch. And they're on the Financial Action Task Force gray list. And the challenge is that the banks in Suriname for the Surinamese people can't get money sent to them from people that live in Holland or people that live in the United States. They can't send money home. Because if you've got a bank account with Santander, with a bank account with Citibank, HSBC, whatever it is, they will refuse to send your money to a bank in Suriname. And likewise, when the Surinamese, they want to travel to the U.S. or they want to travel to Holland or whatever the case is, their cards don't work overseas. They can't transact. Right. This isn't a problem of technology. It's a problem of policy, of regulations, because in the participation of the Financial Action Task Force, they literally get together all these countries. They send their delegates, just like they send them to the United Nations or to the IMF. They send their delegates to FATF, they call it, F-A-T-F, FATF. And they have these committees and subcommittees in FATF, and they go around and they do these country studies, country by, and they give you a score. So if you don't play by their rules, then your people are not permitted to transact, and it keeps them in arbitrary poverty.
So to play devil's advocate for a moment, wouldn't an instrument like a CBDC, wouldn't a system like a CBDC allow to be able to see exactly how money moves and with to who it moves to in order to make those decisions more fairly? I'm just playing devil's advocate here.
Yeah, absolutely. Who do you think gets to see that and make those decisions? Because it's not going to be you, and it sure as hell isn't going to be me. Nobody listening is going to get to see that.
Right. It's still going to be closed off, is what you're saying.
Nobody's going to get to look at it. I can't look at your bank transactions now. You're never going to be able to see mine.
Right.
The people that get to see it are the ones that decide.
Right. Because the thing about it is that since CBDCs have this underlying technical layer, which is the blockchain, and with the blockchain comes, for a lot of people, this ideology of transparency, decentralization, just attaching the term blockchain to CBDCs for some reasons, for some people, might be enough for them to understand that this is going to be better because they think blockchain equals more transparency, more, you know, decentralization, and all those things, of course, are good. So why wouldn't a CBDC be good? So I'm just pulling at that string.
No, I'm glad you're really doing that, right? And so the first thing that we need to think about is that blockchain is one kind of distributed ledger technology. There are other kinds which could be utilized in the case of a central bank digital currency. It doesn't necessarily have to be blockchain. For example, it could be DAG, decentralized acyclic graph technology, which sometimes allows for faster transaction reconciliation, more transactions per second, you know, really just blow right past Visa transaction speeds. And possible solutions that people are looking at implementing in CBDC programs around the world. So if we start there, right? But then assuming that in the decision tree analysis, we say, okay, we're choosing blockchain for a CBDC, then you have to think about your technology stack. And that's when you think about, right, when your layer one technology is, you know, is who's going to have read permission, who's going to have write permission, who's going to have view permissions, who is, like, who's going to be able to write the transactions of the blockchain? Is it going to be what portions of it is going to be publicly accessible? What portions of it are going to be permissioned? I mean, it will work similar to what we have today in that you'll have to prove your identity to have access to the network. And then the idea is that your identity is going to be permanent to you, right? You'll have it from permanently from cradle to grave, that it's going to be portable so that you'll be able to work with you throughout wherever you may go worldwide, that it'll be personal to you, right? In the sense that it will be authenticated with multi-factor biometrics. And then lastly, it's supposed to be, they're going to tell you that it's private. They're going to tell you that this is going to protect your privacy and that it's going to protect you from hacking and bad actors and all kinds of things. But that's the trick. They're going to get you on the privacy, because the difference between Bitcoin as a blockchain technology and a central bank digital currency in the privacy aspect is that in a CBDC, the Federal Reserve will know everything about you. And I didn't really understand how important this was until I was a special magistrate on, and I had to hold a hearing and review 2,000 pages of bank records and make a determination as a magistrate on a case involving a digital asset dispute. And when I read those 2,000 pages of bank records for somebody else, it was amazing to me the information that I knew about this person, the patterns in their behaviors. And I could tell you where they got their coffee and who was their gym trainer and what all of their subscriptions were. And so much information. And the government is going to have all of that on you. You think it's bad that Amazon or Google knows you're pregnant before you do? What if the Federal Reserve Bank knows you're pregnant before you do?
Now, taking back, going back to the World Economic Forum document, I am seeing on the next point, and I'm going to quote again, it says here for wholesale CBDCs again, it says it could reduce settlement and counterparty risks and enable delivery versus payment or payment versus payment in cross-border interbank securities transactions and funds. Programmable nature of wholesale CBDC could also apply to other uses, and e.g. within financial market infrastructures. That programmable aspect of CBDCs, does that concern you in specifically, that programmable aspect of a CBDC?
Oh yeah. It's awful. It's all kinds of awful. Nothing good can ever come from this. This is the most horrible thing that could ever happen to humanity.
Having an account where I have, I don't know how much money in the form of CBDCs, just sitting there in an account and knowing that it, at any point, you know, it could be transferred or it could be disabled or it could be altered in such a way that doesn't give me access to it. Is that what concerns you the most, or is there anything specific about it?
It's going, your money's going to expire.
So that you can't have it saved for too long?
You're not going to be allowed to have any savings. And I only laugh a little bit because, like, it's terribly upsetting. If I don't laugh, I might cry. It's terrible.
What would be the motive behind that, to your understanding? What would be the overall end game of a government saying, I'm going to keep you from having savings. I'm going to force you to spend your money and you have a time frame of 5 years to do so. Otherwise, it just vanishes.
So we've got universal basic income. And the universal basic income is supposedly the solution to the havoc that AI is going to generate upon the populations of the world.
Yeah. And that's worthy of a completely other podcast.
Yeah, that's another podcast, but like it's all happening all at once. And I have to tell you, it's like, I feel like there's a bit of an acceleration that's happening. You know, I foresaw this. I've actually been giving like these lectures and talking about these issues for past, I want to say like 6 years.
Okay.
And so I used to talk about these things and now they're actually happening. And I'm like, oh my gosh, this is terrifying. But yeah, so the CBDC is programmable money. The intention is that you will be given a certain allowance over a period of time, like say allowance by week or allowance by month, and you will need to spend your money or it will expire. And of course you are limited and controlled on how you can spend your money.
So,
it's not yours.
So in essence, what you're saying is that in this current form of thinking, which it seems like the World Economic Forum is taking into account when they're, because it's under their column of key opportunities, which is just them identifying it as a benefit, as something to be considered as good, in for lack of more advanced terms. The programmability of a CBDC, that element to you poses the greatest threat if it were implemented?
Well, it really kind of comes down to the whole control, right? That it's centralized control over your ability to transact freely with your neighbor.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, right. And it goes back to the exact same problem I thought I was going to solve with very naively, right? With my Guatemalan migrant worker client.
That's what I was going to say. Like going back to your example of that client, how do you think that situation would have played out if it would have happened within a context of him having all those funds in CBDC? Like what do you think would have happened?
Well, technically, he never would have been allowed to pick the tomatoes for money because, he would have, his government issued ID would have had to have matched some sort of an H-2B worker visa scenario, and it didn't. So
he wouldn't have had that job to begin with.
Right. It wouldn't have happened.
Okay. Right. So let's just take a brief example in the last 4 minutes that we have left. Let's just explore this with me because you have so much experience out and about, like in the actual context of things. Is a CBDC and its programmability offering the government a new tool of coercion or offering a new tool of punishment?
Yeah.
For citizens when they are in the context where those types of legal operations can take an effect.
Absolutely. Yes. They just turn everything off, right? So think about it from this perspective. So if my bank account, Bank of America, right, was attached to the central bank digital currency FedNow system, then and Bank of America, and the government didn't like me coming on this podcast and saying all of these things, these negative things about central bank digital currency. Right? They're like, yeah, I don't like what you have to say about this. Like, clearly use this example.
Of course.
Then what they do is they just simply shut down my bank account such that my debit card, my credit cards, nothing works. Nothing works. I go to Publix. I can't make a purchase. I need to put gas in my car. I can't make a purchase. My electric bill comes due to pay for the house. Mm-hmm. I can't pay for it. And then my electric gets turned off. My water gets turned off. My natural gas power gets turned off. My internet gets turned off. My mobile phone gets turned off, right? I go hungry. I can't get water. I can't get food. I can't go to my mother's house up in Ohio to take care of me because I can't get there. I can't buy a bus ticket. I can't buy plane ticket. I can't do anything. I am frozen and at the total mercy of the U.S. federal government.
So in your point of view, this is a new form of utilizing the state's or the sovereign state's monopoly on violence, but utilizing it in a digital facet. Would that be fair?
Well, yeah, they just totally shut you off. And of course, they gave that a dry run in Canada and it worked pretty well. It shut down the trucker protests pretty quickly.
Well, that's a fair point. I can't argue that. Well, We are already out of time. I can't believe that, you know, the time already flew. It flew. I am so happy we had this conversation. And as I mentioned to you before we started recording, and as I've mentioned before in prior guests, the whole point of our commission or our subcommission is to serve as a platform so that these issues can be discussed and different points of view can be brought to the limelight and discussed openly. And I am so grateful and so happy that we're able to bring your point of view forward, because I am sure that it's going to be a platform for discussion. So thank you so much for giving us your time and offering such insight on such an interesting and important matter as what CBDCs seem to be.
Thank you so much for having me. Hopefully next time we can talk about solutions.
I would love that. Anessa, thank you so much once again for having us. And to everyone listening, thank you so much for your time. And we hope to have you, again, listening and tuning in to the Colegio de Abogados y Abogadas de Puerto Rico's podcast. So thank you so much and see you next time.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.